From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, Senior Lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the Dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Professor Denise Mama Pope. I've used that before.
You have, but I am a mom.
You are, and we're talking about youngins today.
Yeah, little ones.
So let me ask you a question.
Okay.
Which year of school is the most significant?
Out of all 12, 16, 17 years?
Let's say K-12. Which year? If I had to get rid of a year, which year would I not get rid of?
Well, oh no, I would do it the other way. If you had to get rid of a year, I mean, any one of the middle school years. I was just like,
this
let's
is from
just
the point. This
get
is from
rid
the
of middle school.
This
okay?
is the point of view of a teacher dealing with puberty.
Yes. And also, no, and also a mom of kids going through middle school. Middle school is just, ugh.
That's what I taught. Why are you picking on those poor children?
I will say this. For teachers who teach middle school, you have a special place in heaven because there is a lot of patience involved. Some people think teachers of preschoolers or of kindergarten or first grade, there's a special place in heaven for all teachers. But I think for middle school, that's tough.
But isn't that exactly the reason you need school? It's a time of rapid development and change.
Okay, yeah, you got me. So, all right, let's go back to your question. What do you think? Which year of school is most significant?
So the reason I'm thinking of this is people want to start earlier education. So like a transitional kindergarten, say fourth grade, or even earlier, third grade. So the reason I'm trying to think about what year I could eliminate is because I think school in earlier, like for 3 and 4 year olds, is really important. But it's expensive. And so a lot of people say it's too expensive. So I'm thinking, well, why don't we just cannibalize like third grade or fourth grade? Fourth grade, you're basically just repeating what you did in third grade. Just get rid of it. And then we can get all those teachers credentialed with BAs to teach children at the age of 4 and 3.
So there's nothing in your head that says we need 12 years of compulsory schooling. Or we do need 12 years, but we're not starting it early enough.
I'm saying we need 12 years. I believe in early enrichment a tremendous amount. I believe in it enough, in enrichment, you know, broad experiences, that I actually explicitly take my dog to places like the beach, the mountains.
You do not.
I do. I take my dog.
To expose him
Yes.
Wait, what is this doing for your dog, Dan?
My dog is so worried about everything. So I'm overwhelming him. But these early years strike me as very important. But it's very expensive to add a new grade. And so people are arguing that. I think we should pay for it, to pay teachers to go younger. But a lot of people don't. And so I'm just saying, well, why don't we just get rid of third or fourth grade?
All right, so I'll go with that.
Was this stupid?
I'm down with that. No, I think third grade teachers weeping now because you're eliminating their job, but you're saying we'll retrain you, third grade teachers. Go down to second grade, and everyone goes down a grade.
Well, let them choose. They could go to fourth grade.
So why are we talking about this, Dan?
Because we have a world's expert with us who can talk about the value. Or whether there is value in a pre-K education. So I'm very pleased to have Professor Francis Pierman with us today. He's a faculty member in the School of Education, and his research and policy interests concern social inequality, racial stratification, and educational disparities in the contemporary U.S. city. And in this particular case, he has some work coming out on differential effects of pre-K. And so, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're glad you're here.
So, there are lots of people who want to find out whether pre-K makes a difference. So, I remember Sesame Street, right, with Big Bird. Does Sesame Street make a difference? And it's really a tough thing to find out, to find out if the kids who got exposed to this, does it have an effect 6 years later, right?
I mean, I know Sesame Street makes a difference just in defense of Sesame Street. There's been some nice studies about that. I don't know about the longevity. I don't know if it stays. So,
Well, I'm sure Sesame Street has helped some companies make money.
Okay, but I also
was that,
think
was that the wrong? Was that too cynical?
Okay, yeah, that was pretty cynical, Dan.
Okay, I'm back on track here.
Okay.
So these are hard studies to conduct because you basically it's not like you can, maybe you can, but it's not like I take half the kids and I say you don't get pre-K. You do get pre-K, and then I wait for 4 or 5 years and then I see how they're doing. Or is that what you did? So how do you do this?
Right. So you're speaking to one of those like fundamental challenges associated with doing this type of work, and that's the difficulty of designing really rigorous evaluations, or in the case that I'm going to talk about today, experiments. You can think about sort of evaluating effects one way, and in this particular way, you could conduct what are conventionally known as retrospective studies. So you might identify kids at a later point in time, assess them on some outcome, determine which of those kids attended pre-K, and adjust for whatever observable differences you can, and see if there's a difference in the outcome. And there's a long line of research within this sort of.
They're sort of like medical studies where you find out what people ate and, look, all the people who ate kale seem to be doing better.
Right. And you're speaking to one of the challenges associated with doing that type of research, and that's the inability to distinguish or the inability to identify whether or not these two groups were different to begin with, right?
Right.
So perhaps these groups, one group received pre-K, another group did not receive pre-K, and perhaps the group that attended pre-K is doing better, let's say on some middle school outcome. It's possible that those children who did better in pre-K, did better in the middle school years, we're going to do better whether or not they got pre-K.
Right. They were richer kids.
They were wealthier kids.
Exactly.
They had more motivated parents. Yeah. And perhaps those are the same reasons why they got pre-K to begin with.
Yes.
Right. So that's the fundamental tension or the challenge that's really plagued a lot of early childhood
research. So how did you
research.
Do it? How did
right.
you do it?
Right. So in 2009, Tennessee really started implementing their statewide pre-K program. And Vanderbilt University, which is where I did my graduate work, a team of researchers there saw an opportunity to conduct what was and still is the first ever experimental evaluation of a statewide pre-K program. Now, there have been experimental evaluations of Head Start and so forth, but I have a statewide program. There hadn't been one done. So what we did in this particular experiment was we identified which pre-K centers across the state of Tennessee were oversubscribed, right? And on those oversubscription lists, we essentially randomized who would get an offer to attend pre-K or not. And what's critical about, or what's really the distinguishing characteristic here is by randomizing off the applicant list, not only are you sort of ensuring that the sample isn't biased by people who did or did not want to get into pre-K. They all wanted to get into pre-K, right? But through these randomization methods, you can ensure that the children who got into pre-K were were equivalent on observable characteristics as well as unobservable characteristics to children who did not wind up being given access to pre-K.
So a lack of capacity of the system allowed you to know that some kids wouldn't get it, and then you could randomize which kids got it and didn't.
Correct. So with this evaluation, the first studies that came out with respect to the Tennessee voluntary pre-K program were largely positive. At the end of pre-K, children were more kindergarten ready. And that's sort of the key sort of term in this space.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We're talking with Frances Pearman about preschool and how you know if preschool has a good effect. So you started the study. You looked at who got into these preschools, randomly decided, looked at some who were going, some who weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us what you found.
Right. So the immediate term outcomes were largely positive. Children who were randomly assigned to attend pre-K went on to be more kindergarten ready a year later. Even at the end of pre-K year, you saw these positive effects on a host of outcomes. And then at the start of pre-K, they were better prepared for their sort of the beginning of their schooling trajectory. And that was a big finding, right? That was a big finding that a aligned with a lot of previous observational research that we just noted previously. However, 2 years later, something really interesting happened, and that was those positive overall effects began to fade. And in some cases, actually reversed by third grade. What that means is that by third grade, children in the experimental treatment group, the children who were assigned to pre-K, were doing no better at third grade. Now, this process, this phenomenon, is commonly known as pre-K fade out. Right? This is the issue whereby children who have these initial gains associated with pre-K, those gains fade over time, and that phenomena fade out has been documented in quite a bit. I mean, the Head Start Impact study saw the same sort of patterns, and a number of other sort of high fidelity type studies are seeing these noticeable fade outs.
I'm depressed. That's very depressing.
So before we find out the answer, what's your theory?
I just want to register that I'm quite sad because all we've been hearing about is universal pre-K and how important pre-K is, and we know that it makes a difference for them to be ready for kindergarten, and that's got to be good. And then you're going to tell me a few years later there's no difference.
So you think there's something spurious about that finding, or you think this is possible?
No. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to explain it, except that something's happening between kindergarten and third grade to reverse the effect of preschool. Is school that horrific that they just like go back to where they were? I don't know. I mean, how do you explain it, Dan?
Well, this is why we brought in Francis.
You're punting. Okay. Yes. Francis, how do you explain it?
Right. So, so I want to sort of insert this new study into this conversation.
Okay.
That was just published. So how the debate about pre-K oftentimes goes is, okay, we can talk about what happens in pre-K classrooms. What is the correct teaching? What is the correct curricula? What do the structure of those classrooms need to look like in order to have these long-term effects, both short and long-term effects? What's missing in a lot of those conversations is what a social scientist refer to is the counterfactual condition. In other words, what children experience in the absence of pre-K. And that part of the sort of the pre-K conversation has, or that aspect of the conversation has largely been dormant over the last few years. Critical evaluations of what children would experience in the absence of pre-K and how that could relate to sort of whether or not effects are observed, right? So you could, I mean, one way to kind of think about it is, you know, the impacts that pre-K has on any type of outcome, you know, that impact might be a level 3, right? On, some arbitrary metric. You know, in the absence of pre-K, perhaps that child who didn't attend that pre-K would have experienced what would amount to a level 2. Right. For that kid, experiencing a level 3 is a positive thing. However, you can imagine for some kids, what they would experience in the absence of pre-K could have been a 4 or a 5. Now, in the absence of pre-K, child could actually potentially be.
So, for example, instead of going to a lousy pre-K, they may have a really good family life where the parents teaching them along the way.
Taking them to museums, taking their dogs to parks.
That's a possibility. So the question is, how might we interrogate the variation in this sort of counterfactual condition? So I do a lot of work related to place and how geography impacts educational inequality. So I'm primed to think in those terms anytime I'm thinking through a matter of educational significance. So I brought this question to this data of whether or not we would observe similar effects of pre-K exposure across neighborhood types, right? And there's really three reasons why one would expect these effects to differ. One of which is we know that communities differ in terms of their alternative childcare options. And this is you. I think you were alluding to this,
right?
To some extent, what that means is, or what the data indicates is that more affluent communities have greater early childhood opportunities, whether we're talking about formal, informal daycare facilities, whether we're talking about other private
right, like gymboree classes, gymboree, and music together, mommy and me.
Exactly. Yeah. So if there is that sort of variation, one would expect that pre-K would be more beneficial for the kids who perhaps didn't have those options potentially available to them in their community. That's one reason. Two, we also know that communities differ in terms of their contextual risk factors. Why that matters is there's a kind of a theory for why pre-K effects matter for later outcomes, and that being that pre-K operates in part by safeguarding children from periods of elevated developmental vulnerability. And in that case, one would also expect that, okay, if these communities differ in terms of how much exposure children have to these community risk factors, pre-K would be most beneficial in the communities where pre-K could do the most safeguarding,
right,
if that makes sense.
Can you explain, like, what's a risk factor? What would be a risk factor?
Yeah, so a risk factor, exposure to crime and violence in a community, exposure to what we might think of as like unstable home lives, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of relocation, a lot of neighbors moving in and out.
Food insecurity.
All of those.
Okay,
so the idea being that perhaps pre-K is creating some semblance of structure, some semblance of order for children, and that could be developmentally meaningful as well.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We are talking with Frances Pearman about pre-K and the benefits of pre-K and what happens to kids who do and don't go.
We know that pre-K benefits the most economically disadvantaged families. Right. And we also know that the most economically disadvantaged families are often clustered together in the same neighbors. I mean, that's the phenomena of
poverty.
Income segregation, or the concentration of poverty.
Right.
Right. So for those reasons, we would there's quite a bit of reason to suspect that pre-K effects would differ across contexts. So with that in mind, I went and reanalyzed this data that, again, produced these positive effects at pre-K entry that by third grade had essentially gone away, and asked whether or not they went away for the children who really needed them. Mm-hmm. It's another way to kind of frame
it. That's good.
And that's precisely what the paper found. In the most economically disadvantaged areas in Tennessee, you saw these strong positive effects of pre-K, in particular on reading achievement, that lasted into at least third grade.
Wow. So we will come back to figure out if pre-K is worth it or not, if we should get rid of third grade in order to pay for pre-K, and more about what these studies mean. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Frances Pearman next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking with Frances Pearman about pre-K and what happens when the advantages of pre-K fades out long after pre-K is over.
So I want to get crystal clear on this. So basically, let's pretend we have two groups of kids or families. One is well-to-do. They're in a good location. The other one, not so well-to-do, not such a great location. And so let's focus the well-to-do. Half of them go to pre-K, half do not. And then when I look at them at third grade, the two groups look about the same. And the explanation is, well, the well-to-do families, you know, if their kids aren't in pre-K, they have lots of alternatives that provide both protection and nurturing for these children.
Like a nanny or
enrichment classes
or daycare centers that offer good stuff.
Sure.
Okay.
They ship them off to grandma.
Or they ship them to grandma.
Who's a really good teacher. So yeah. What I'm asking is... across the board, there's big effects. Mm-hmm. But for just the upper strata, mm-hmm, where you sort of separated them out, the upper strata, do we see a benefit right away of pre-K versus whatever rich alternatives they have?
Yeah. Okay. So I hear you're saying more exclusively about the high income or the – excuse me. I also need to be clear. The entire sample is low income. Right. The entire sample of this study is low-income children.
Interesting.
One of the unique findings from this study was even amongst this population of exclusively low-income children defined by free and reduced price lunch status, which we know is not a perfect proxy, low-income children in Tennessee, a considerable share of them lived in low-poverty areas, right? So really what we're talking about isn't even the counterfactual that you're describing. It's the counterfactual of low-income children who are still living in relatively affluent areas that might have these sort of contextual resources in their surrounding residential communities. To your point about whether or not these effects are showing up immediately for those kids. Yes, we were seeing these sort of immediate effects across the whole population, including this population.
So for that group, there is fade out.
Correct.
For the low income but healthy environments.
Correct.
There is fade out for them.
Correct.
Now, for the ones who are not in such good environments, you see strong differences right after pre-K, and they stick till third grade.
Correct. And I think there's an important connection to the other study that we haven't talked yet about that's also forthcoming. And that's, you can think of like, who does pre-K benefit? Like that's a good big question. One answer that the first paper that we were speaking about extensively for the first half of the interview, the answer that paper says is, well, it's going to benefit the children whose counterfactual condition is lowest. Another way to say that is it's going to benefit the kids who need it the most,
right?
Who without it, perhaps, you could think of, a latchkey situation, right? Where kids are at home, parents are at work, right? Or perhaps, they are with a family member, but the sort of the enrichment of those learning experiences is very low. That's one answer to that question. Another answer to that question, and this is where the second paper sort of speaks to, another answer to that question is, well, the gains associated with pre-K are also more likely to exist amongst children who go on to experience high quality subsequent learning environments, right? And just to reiterate, we're still talking about a low income population, right? The key finding of there's two key findings from this line of research about sort of sustaining environments. What are the conditions under which pre-K effects persist over time? What we found in this paper, and myself along with several colleagues at Vanderbilt and North Carolina and Georgia, what we found in this paper was that there is a small fraction of low-income children in Tennessee who actually went on to have high-quality teachers and high-quality schools, but that was a very small fraction of children. Upwards on about 10% of the population went on to experience what we would think of as high-quality subsequent learning environments. What that suggests is that the vast majority of children actually were experiencing what we might think of as low-quality subsequent learning experiences. The number of children who were exposed to what are termed in what we term in the paper as high quality teachers, there was a significant fraction of our population that did not experience one highly effective teacher between kindergarten and fourth grade. And again, we're talking about low income children in Tennessee. What this is suggesting is that we're having really important conversations about pre-K. The evidence is fairly conclusive that pre-K makes kids more kindergarten ready, right? However, we're seeing these fade out. But what this paper is suggesting is that it's possible that there are some learning conditions after pre-K that could be promotive of longer term effects. But the vast majority of children aren't exposed to those conditions.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Frances Pearman about pre-K and how to keep the positive effects of pre-K going. And it sounds like for low-income kids in the second study, just a bunch of kids did not have the experiences of high-quality teachers that would potentially help keep that fade out from happening.
So I think this is an important point. I think oftentimes people think of pre-K as like it's a critical period. And if you can just get it right, the kids are inoculated.
Right. It's like a panacea. It's to solve everything.
Well, it's like getting a vaccine. We give them pre-K like a vaccine, and after that, they should be fine, no matter what their educational experience is. But here, turns out, no, it puts them on a trajectory to take advantage of high quality stuff when it shows up.
That's precisely the finding, right? How I often try to orient the conversation around early childhood is to think more expansively about what it means to support children during their early childhood years. And oftentimes that means a broader focus than thinking exclusively about pre-K. I mean, the analogy that I oftentimes think about, and I used to run track, pre-K is a great first leg in a relay, right? Now, anybody who's familiar with track, you could have a great first leg, but if your second, third, and fourth
great
leg
analogy.
Are no good, you're going to lose that race, right? Yes, having a good first leg benefits you. That's fantastic. But we also got to think about those.
That's very good.
I like the analogy, too.
No, it's very good. So has anybody done the study I want, which is half the kids go to third grade and half don't?
Which is we're just cutting out a full year of education because Dan thinks that'll help us pay.
Okay. I actually think it's fourth grade or fifth grade.
Maybe what we need for this study is a little gap year so that everyone can have a better high quality post pre-K experience, wherever that may be.
Yeah, and this, I mean, there's also a related something related to what you're talking about that will be found in this second study, and that's that the benefits of having a high quality teacher in elementary schools differ depending on subject in terms of the sustaining environment's thesis about pre-K effects. That is, having an early having a high quality kindergarten first grade teacher is really beneficial for children's English and language arts, reading, literacy, performance in third grade. For math, it's actually the later grades. It's the grades closer to second and third grade. Now again, we're talking about third
grade.
Fine,
Denise, we'll keep third.
You got to keep third. For the math, I'm hearing you got to keep third.
But what I also wanted to make this point as well. However, what we do see in Tennessee, and this is not my work, a work by a colleague of mine, who's found that that in Tennessee, but this is a phenomenon that likely extends beyond Tennessee, schools are less likely to assign their high quality teacher to the early elementary grades, right? So they're more likely to assign those teachers around the grades where standardized testing occurs. Mm-hmm. Now, what that suggests is that, for reading achievement with respect to the second study that we're talking about, perhaps that's not in the best interest of kids in terms of their
literacy.
That's
a really interesting policy implication.
So there's a couple takeaways then. One, preschool, good.
Particularly for people who need it the most.
Yeah. And two, more high-quality elementary school teachers, please.
And keep third grade.
And keep third grade.
If you care about reading.
And keep third grade. And take your dog to parks and museums.
No, let it go. I got to let that go.
Francis, thank you so much for joining us. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.